This podcast of Word of Mouth is sponsored by
Doucette Survey,
serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England,
now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
And
Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money
through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans.
Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
And Dartmouth-Hitchcock.
Creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
Word of Mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott. In mid-April, ABC aired a Barbara Walters interview with Mary Kay Letourneau, the teacher convicted of two counts of felony second-degree rape of a child. The next evening, Saturday Night Live aired a skit which satirized the idea that students who have sex with attractive female teachers are somehow the envy of their peers and not victims of sexual assault. The sketch was met with considerable backlash on social and traditional media, denouncing the show's tone-deaf depiction of rape. Despite this persistent narrative that young men are not preyed upon in the same way as young women, an increasing number of female teachers are being arrested for sexual assault in the U.S., and Barbara Goldberg, a national correspondent with Reuters, joins us now to talk about the crackdown. Barbara, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you for speaking with me.
What are the statistics here? How many prosecutions for sexual assault in the U.S., in U.S. schools just last year?
Well, there's not a lot of statistics being kept, but there is one fellow who is a former chief of staff of the U.S. Department of Education who has made it his mission to get a handle on it. And he found, looking in news reports for the last year daily, that there were 800 school employees prosecuted for sexual assault last year, and nearly a third of them were women.
Is that a big increase over previous years?
Well, I looked high and low to try and sort of, encapsulate exactly what's going on here. And in all the literature, it looked like consistently year after year, women sort of got a slide compared to men when we're talking about teachers and school employees. They were consistently got more lenient treatment from the school, including, just sort of looking the other way for some reason. And it looks like that is changing now.
So what would you say explains this uptick in prosecutions of female teachers committing sexual assault?
Well, interestingly, it looks like from talking to the experts that one of the seismic shifts that's going on here in prosecution is that there are many more female police officers, female prosecutors, and female judges. And that all sort of adds up together to a different attitude towards abuse.
And when you say having a different attitude, you mean less likely to let it slide as something that the male student might have wanted or might have asked for or might have even pursued?
Yes, with women prosecuting and adjudicating these cases, there's much more of a recognition that you violate the statute, no matter who you are, you're going to be punished.
Is there any indication that these prosecutions are helping to prevent sexual assault, or are we just seeing, cases that have probably just been ignored, underreported, now we're just finally aware of them?
Yeah, hard to say because, like I said, the statistics are so, are just not being, haven't been kept. This fellow is now starting to keep them. We now have a benchmark, at least from last year. And so far, comparing year after year, it is only 1 month, but in the cases for January of this year compared to January of last year, there are more cases of women being prosecuted. In terms of whether there's any kind of deterrent, there is also, in analyzing some of this information, it looks like women teachers tend to reach out to their victims more through social media.
Mm.
That's how they make this contact more than male teachers. And that also creates a paper trail, more, effective prosecutions because they're, leaving footprints. But there's a movement afoot in many schools to crack down on social media contact between teachers and students to try and prevent this from going on.
You know, the Mary Kay Letourneau case was a huge media sensation, and now 10 years later, she's talking to Barbara Walters with her husband, the former student, her now husband, and they have two kids together. You know, they're presenting this picture of a happy family, and I wonder if you think that that case and maybe some other cases have really confused this issue for the public.
Well, I don't know a lot about that case. I do know that he had some substance abuse issues. But I will say that in one of the cases recently where a judge was very insensitive and gave a female teacher something like 30 days for a relationship with a male student and made a comment about how, you know, attractive the teacher was.
Wow.
Even in that case, the prosecutor had said to him, this student, when he should have been having a fantastic senior year, had a horrible senior year as a result of this relationship. He had still has problems, you know, establishing social relationships with people. And he's basically a mess as a result of that relationship. The male victims experience many of the same, if not all of the same, downsides as female victims do. And with male students also, there's a lot of self-doubt because, you know, any adolescent person, and especially an adolescent male, their body is going to respond. I mean, and they feel, you know, they may not have total control over themselves. And so there's a lot of doubt, like, well I kind of got myself into this. You know, I was very interested in this relationship. And it's very confusing.
So do you expect to see this crackdown continue and numbers to go up?
Yes, I do. I actually think that as more people pay attention and more people are emboldened to come out and feel like they are going to have a voice and be listened to, I think that you'll see a lot more.
Barbara Goldberg, thank you so much for speaking with me.
Oh, thank you.
Barbara Goldberg is a national correspondent with Reuters covering the Northeast. You'll find a link to read her article, U.S. Cracks Down on Female Teachers Who Sexually Abuse Students. That's at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. And word of mouth stays in the classroom. Up next, a look at one school district's push to bring gardening into the class curriculum and why it wasn't as easy as you might imagine. That story after a break.
Word of mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby in for Virginia Prescott. Gardening in America is flourishing, so says a report from the National Gardening Association. Since 2008, households growing their own food has increased by 17%, with the fastest growth seen among millennials. And some schools are trying to capture that enthusiasm. A few years ago, the Salt Lake City School District had greenhouses installed at a dozen elementary and junior schools in an effort to introduce a new garden-based curriculum. But as Ross Chambliss reports, many of the schools aren't quite sure what to do with them.
It's a breezy spring afternoon at Escalante Elementary School, just west of downtown Salt Lake City, and students in Mr. Haglund's sixth grade class are a little bit dirty. The boys have been digging around in manure, and the girls have been pulling out thick weeds from a garden. Some stop to show off some worms they found.
So where are you finding all these worms?
The ground. We have a worm bin that we keep, and we feed them, and then we use the worm castings. To grow plants in our own classroom, and then we come out and plant them out here.
We planted beets, tomatoes, carrots.
We've planted tons of flowers.
Yeah, and tulips.
Like pansies.
They're busy. They're thirsty, but they're all staying busy.
This is Roger Haglund, their teacher.
My sixth graders are building a compost bin. I'm one of the sixth grade curriculum requirements is how do things decompose using microorganisms. So we're making a composting bin to talk about worms and the microbes that help break down waste and turn it back into useful soil or fertilizer.
Last year, the Salt Lake School District, which acquired a combined $300,000 from the home improvement store Lowe's and a grant from the Daniels Fund based in Denver, had almost a dozen greenhouses installed in the schoolyard of this school and several others in the Salt Lake District.
I mean, it was a wonderful gift, and they assumed that people would just take it on, but a lot of people just didn't know what to do.
That's Mary Jo Tedesco, a master gardener with Utah State University Extension. She and a couple other gardening consultants, including the nonprofit Wasatch Community Gardens, are now working with the teachers at Escalante Elementary, where the district is trying to get a pilot program flourishing.
The reality is that the teachers are very, very busy doing so much of their own curriculum. This is sort of added on top of their huge load. So it's been a challenge.
With gardening becoming increasingly popular, education officials in Utah's urban area school districts are now wanting to give students more hands-on life sciences and agricultural lessons than what they might otherwise have in the larger cities. Yet even as the Salt Lake School District is investing in these programs, many teachers are having to learn how to grow vegetables and other plants for the first time so that they can in turn teach their own students. Brittany Anderson teaches fifth grade.
Without them, it would be really difficult. I mean, I ran the gardens last year, and it was really difficult to get a lot of teachers involved. But when they have someone that's an expert in the area working directly with them, we've had so much more involvement in planting and gardening and it being meaningful. Because I think a lot of teachers start seeds and then maybe just send them home, you know, because they don't know what else to do with them.
Since the teachers and the gardeners have started collaborating at Escalante, a diverse school where at least 20 different languages are spoken by students' families, Anderson says some parents even came out to build garden boxes and shelves for the greenhouses, and reactions from others have been very supportive.
Because a lot of our parents don't have the space to be able to do a garden at their house. A lot of them don't have, I mean, we have a lot of refugees and a lot of immigrants. This isn't the land they're used to. The crops we grow here are not the crops they're used to. And so I think it's really kind of powerful for their kids to learn how they can do that here, maybe even how they could bring their own seeds here and we can try doing some of the stuff they're accustomed to.
While it provides a cultural bridge for immigrant children trying to find their place in Utah, district officials say they're also concerned with something referred to as STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math. This is Cynthia Talbot-Holtz with the Salt Lake School District.
We're in a little bit of a crisis in this country with students choosing career pathways in STEM areas. We understand that we have to start with our youngest children, creating that interest and awareness, and not only with our students, but with their parents as well, that the investment they make in their child's education, especially in the STEM areas, will lead those children to lifelong lucrative careers.
Outdoor classroom projects may also help kids concentrate and perform better on tests, according to some studies. But what's more, Tedesco says, these early experiences are profoundly shaping their attitudes towards the environment.
It's huge. I mean, you start them this young and teach them to carefully plant something, to carefully nurture it, to carefully look through the soil. It makes a huge difference in how they see the world.
Other gardeners also helping the teachers with outdoor lessons, like Laura Judd with Wasatch Community Gardens, says ideally she and others will be working themselves out of the job.
Yes, everybody needs a start. Not everybody's a gardener. But after working for a year or two, hopefully there's some ideas in the way the system works here that, you know, we teach, they teach. It gets passed on to grade levels once a month. All the people doing these projects in different schools come together, teach each other. You know, the lessons get published for other teachers in the school district. It spreads out.
And educators are hoping the concept, well, grows. In Salt Lake City, Utah, I'm Ross Chambliss.
A little postscript to that story, the gardening program at Escalante Elementary School is still flourishing. Students, teachers, and parents just celebrated its spring opening last week. When you think of baseball food, you probably think hot dogs, peanuts, big salted pretzels, not kale salads, fresh veggies. And yet, Boston's own Fenway Park will soon be home to the largest organic rooftop gardens in the major leagues. The company maintaining the 5,000-square-foot garden, dubbed Fenway Farms, is named Green City Growers. And joining me now is CEO Jesse Banhazel. Jesse, thanks so much for speaking with me.
Oh, no problem. Happy to.
I don't really think of Fenway as having a roof, per se. So where exactly is this garden, and what are you growing?
Sure. So the location is parallel to the third baseline. Uh-huh. We are currently above Gate A and also above the original Fenway facade. So we're, if you're going to be on the street, we're actually on the corner of Yawkey and Brookline Street, just up one level. So it's on level three in the park. There actually is a little bit of unused space, roof space up there. It's above the administrative offices for the Red Sox. And it's currently, or was originally, just kind of an open rubber roof before the farm went in.
So what are you growing?
We are growing a little bit of everything. Right now, since it's the spring, we're growing lettuce, arugula, radishes. There's some carrots, broccoli, a bunch of different herbs. We've been working with the EMC Club restaurant, which is the smallest restaurant at the park, which is why we've chosen them to be the recipients of the food. We believe that their operation will see the most impact from the size of the garden that we have at Fenway. And so we met with the chefs and we talked about what they use, what they find to be really valuable, what's been hard for them to source. And we're planting a little bit of everything within that category since it's our first year. And moving forward, we'll narrow it down to the crops that we see are going to be working really well with the kitchen operation there.
So the visitors going to the park and who want to eat there will actually get to eat the food that's being grown at Fenway.
Correct, yeah. So if you eat at the EMC Club restaurant, you're going to be able to eat the food that's grown at Fenway. The food service provider for the park is Aramark, and so we've been working with them to get the food to be able to be harvested and then brought right into the walk-in kitchens at the restaurant and served to the public about 25 feet away from where it's being grown.
So do the ball players get, like, a discount? I'm wondering if David Ortiz is going to be snacking on lettuce at first base.
I have no idea. The garden just went in. It went in. The installation happened by a company, a Somerville, Massachusetts company called Recover Green Roofs. They put in the green roofing system, and the farm is actually all in milk crates. So it's milk crates with liners in them, and we filled them with organic soil. And so that got set up a week before opening day. So we actually just started planting and farming a few weeks ago. And so I haven't met any of the players yet. I really hope to. But it's been kind of a constant stream of people from around the park, including the employees at Fenway, coming by, checking and seeing what it's about. And we're getting a lot of really wonderful anecdotal information from people's home gardens. And it's been really, really positive experience so far.
Now, can I guess that you're taking a personal interest in really making sure that this garden is being tended well and maybe getting to catch a few innings?
Yeah, absolutely. So it is my business, and I do spend a lot of time in front of the computer, which is what happens. The bigger your company gets, when we got started, I did a lot of farming, and now I do a lot of administrative work. But I am actually one of the farmers for the Fenway Park site. So we're there twice a homestand, so we're actually farming during the games whenever the Red Sox are in town. And so today, actually, later today, I'm going to be heading out there, and then later this week. So, you know, really, really, really love being there. It's just such a wonderful energy. It's really exciting.
So I was really surprised to read that this isn't the first time vegetables have been grown at Fenway Park, and really that there's, I guess, a small history of baseball gardening. Do you know much about it?
Yeah, there is a small history of baseball gardening. The Chicago ballpark actually had a huge vegetable garden back in the day. And in 2000, one of the bullpen managers had tomatoes growing at Fenway Park. And so he actually had 18 tomatoes growing to symbolize 1918, which at the time was the last time the Red Sox had won the World Series. So it was a little bit of a superstitious play, which is clearly a big part of baseball. And so they had their tomatoes there. But this size and scale of Fenway Farms is much different than what's previously been done before. And it's actually the largest ballpark growing operation in the country.
Now, your company, Green City Growers, all about transforming unused urban spaces. You've got projects in schools around Boston and many other places. What's next? Are you going to scope out the scene at Gillette Stadium, see whether or not they have any interest?
We would love to. You know, I really actually am hoping to look into what the new park, they're moving the Pawtucket Sox to Providence. And so, you know, that would be a great opportunity for a vegetable garden. Clearly, I don't have a lot of say in these decisions. I'm not an owner of the Red Sox, but You know, whenever there's new construction, that's a really great opportunity for incorporating roof projects. It can be a complicated process to incorporate rooftop gardens specifically because there is engineering that you need to take into consideration. You are putting weight on top of the roof. Safety, access, they're all variables that you have to think about. Ground level is a bit simpler, but it's about, you know, finding unused space and changing it over into edible space, which is actually easier than you think. And so, you know, we see a future of a lot more large-scale vegetable gardens, rooftop farms all over New England that would be able to provide not only fresh produce, but places where people can engage in food production, especially in the urban centers. A lot of people grow up without actually having any experience with seeing food grow or knowing the difference between what fresh and processed food really means. And by simply engaging and participating and seeing food growing in a city, you see people have a much deeper connection to their food, which is why we love being at the ballpark. There are just hundreds and hundreds of people walking by that site every single game, and we hear a lot of kids going, "Mom, Mom, that's so cool. The Red Sox have a garden. Why can't we have a garden?" And I think that that's the point.
Well, Jesse, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
No problem. I'm happy to. And come see us at the park.
Oh, I really hope I get the chance.
Great.
Jesse Van Hazel is CEO of Green City Growers, which is maintaining 5,000 square feet of rooftop gardens at Fenway Park. And you can read more about their work at wordofmouthradio.org.
For the first time in 86 years, the Red Sox have won baseball World Championship. Can you believe it?
Spring isn't just a good time for baseball and gardening. It's also a great time for bird watching. Up next on Word of Mouth, how a hard winter has delayed some of the best bird watching and how to prevent birds from flying into your windows. But first, a quick break.
Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Taylor Quimby in for Virginia Prescott. Spring is in the air, and as the temperatures climb and migration gets underway, so are an increasing number of birds. And each season, Eric Masterson joins us to talk about New Hampshire's changing avian ecology. He's land protection specialist with the Harris Center for Conservation Education and also author of Birdwatching in New Hampshire. And Eric, it's always a pleasure to have you on the show.
It's great to be here, Taylor. Thanks for having me.
Of course. So my assumption is that spring is the best time of the year for birdwatching. That's correct, right?
Well, considering we've come out of the winter from hell, this is a very good spring for bird watching. But yes, it is a great time because, you know, we've come out of the winter doldrums and there's nothing better to herald the new and emerging summer than returning birds.
Now, is this still considered early for the best spring bird watching action, or are we right in the thick of it right now?
It's different, and it's different at different times. So it really kicks off. The first birds back are the red-winged blackbirds, and they come back early March. And waterfowl migration is a phenomenon of March. And then you get into April, when some of the early neotropical migrants get back. But the bulk of the long-distance migrants, like warblers, tanagers, bobolinks, they come in May. So we're heading into the best time now, the most exciting time. And it's actually been delayed by about 10 days or so because we've had low pressure sitting over the eastern seaboard for the last 10 days. And that's low pressure equals northerly winds. And so it's basically backed everything up. It's almost like the traffic lights have been stuck on red.
Yeah, I read that this March was one of the coldest on record for the past 100 years. And I was surprised to realize that birds are so responsive to the weather. They're not just kind of on a clock. They really, they're feeling the temperature.
To a degree. Birds that just move south by 100 or 200 miles. So like robins, they stay south of the freeze line, so to speak. They need, you know, robins need, in addition to fruit during the winter, they like unfrozen ground so that they can forage. And they only stay south of the freeze line by and large. I mean, we have some here every winter during the winter, but reduced numbers. But they can respond to warming springs very quickly because they may only be in Massachusetts or Connecticut. Birds that winter south in South America, they don't know what the weather's like here. And so they're on a predetermined clock. They leave based on different factors, photo period and so forth. So they'll get to...
They can't just check AccuWeather.
No, they can't check the web. Maybe, no, they'll never be able to check. I was going to make a stupid joke, but they can't check the web. So they leave based on ancient cues, you know, photo period and so forth, that determines when they leave their winter haunts. They don't make it in one fell swoop. They do day trips, basically, or night trips. They may do 200 miles a night type thing. And so as they get closer, you know, there may be a backup in the mid-Atlantic states now because they've experienced northerly winds. And so they are, it's not that they have stopped their journey entirely. They're just waiting for favorable winds to make a final push. And that's what birders look for. They look for the right weather at this time of year to predict when to take the day off work, you know.
Oh, okay. So what species should people be on the lookout for right now, and how would they identify them? What should people actually be looking for?
Well, I mean, what people are interested in at this time of year are the spring migrants. So we have about 25 species of warblers. And when people think of spring migration, I think the one class of birds that epitomizes that more than any other are warblers, because they're these little gems of our forest. They're brightly colored, beautiful, wonderful songs. And they have this exotic lifestyle. They come from Central and South America, where they winter. And so we should have about 10 or 12 of those in the state by now. There are early, in the class of warblers, there are early arrivals and late arrivals.
When you say 10 or 12, you mean 10 or 12 birds?
No, 10 or 12 species.
Okay.
Yeah, sorry, that's an important clarification. We have a warbler in southwest New Hampshire. Please come quickly. No, about 10 or 12 species. And we only have about 5 or 6 have arrived so far because of these northerly winds and the low pressure systems. So people will notice an uptick in bird songs. So they may start hearing their first rose-breasted grosbeaks, Baltimore Orioles. Birds that should have peaked into the state by now will start arriving. So they'll notice an uptick in bird song, and they will notice some of those warblers that tend to arrive in early May, like chestnut-sided warblers and yellow warblers. They will start noticing those. And as with birds in general, it's easier to hear them than it is to see them, because you can hear around corners and you can hear behind trees, but you can't see. You need line of sight to see, and so we all like to see birds. But the first thing, and this is true, I think I'm speaking for the birding community here, very often our first point of contact with a bird is the sound. And so it's very important to work on identifying birds by sound. And that's an acquired skill like anything else. If you can tell your Mozart from your Brahms, you can tell your yellow warbler from your chestnut-sided warbler. It's just a learned habit.
So I've got a lot of work to do on both of those subjects, I think. Is there a place, like a reference point that people can use to learn birdsong and become accustomed with it?
Yeah. I mean, there's been a revolution in birding because of the advances in technology. So there are apps now. There's all of the major field guides like Sibley, and I think there's one for the Peterson. I know Sibley has an app that has sounds associated. Obviously, a book doesn't come with
sure.
a sound, but the apps do.
And you
so
can bring that with
way.
You if you're, you know, you're actually out hiking
yeah.
or something like that.
There's no substitute for going out with a person who knows more than you. So the best way to learn is to go out with people who know more than you. Unfortunately, in New Hampshire, there's a very large birding community, and there are many field trips throughout the month, throughout the state, opportunities for you to get out with people who know more than you.
Well, we'll talk a little bit more about some events coming up in the near future, but for our listeners, I'm speaking with Eric Masterson. He's author of Birdwatching in New Hampshire. And I wanted to talk about something kind of serious. So last May, your wife found an oven bird that had flown into a window and died. Obviously a very sad occurrence and a pretty familiar one if you work, say, in an office building like we do.
Mm-hmm.
You wrote a really touching remembrance that put its life into perspective for me anyway. And I was wondering if you might share a bit about what made this death and other deaths like it so tragic.
Yeah, I like to think of the individual. So we think of communities, and we kind of lose sight of the individual when we think of communities of people and communities of birds. And so my wife found this bird that wasn't part of a population or a larger picture. It was
sure.
a single individual that had a life story. And that life story is worth remembering. It was born up here somewhere in the temperate forests of North America, maybe last year, maybe 10 years ago, who knows. So let's assume at least it's 1 year old. It went south the preceding fall and wintered somewhere in the West Indies.
So a long ways away.
A long ways away. And then in about February, as the day lengthened, it left, say, Cuba. It traveled across the island of Cuba, past, you know, we have these images of Cuba, the old car, the vintage cars and the sugarcane fields and this kind of exotic landscape. And it made the crossing to Florida, 90 miles of water. And this epic journey, really, avoiding all manner of threats before it reached New Hampshire, the ancestral ones, the ones that have been around for millennia,
the
hawks,
predators, right.
The hawks, and basically lack of food and all of those things that can that cause birds to perish every year. But now we've thrown into the mix habitat destruction, glass buildings. It's a very difficult to put a hard figure on the number of birds killed by striking glass windows. But the estimates are anywhere in the 100 to several hundred million birds a year, because they look at a window, especially one that's reflecting natural vegetation, and they just see natural vegetation. And so the bird my wife found had flown into one of our windows. And that in itself is sad. But when you think of what that bird has been through, only to reach New Hampshire after having gone south to Cuba or wherever else in the West Indies it spent, travel back north to New Hampshire, and then to meet its end by flying into my stupid window, when there is something that I could do. And I have done. I've put up hawk decals on my windows, placement of shrubs. If you're going to feed birds, trying to be cognizant of where the feeding is happening so that they're not going to launch straight into the window when they fly away from the bird feeder. There are American Birds Conservancy and other nonprofits are working to develop bird-friendly glass that has microscopic stripes or UV coatings that will further enhance a bird's ability to see the glass. So we're making strides. But I just wanted to point out that it's not just an oven bird. It's a story, and it's a story that deserves respect, and this bird deserves our respect. And it seems an awful shame to have what is an epic story end by carelessness on or lack or ignorance on my part.
Yeah. And you said, so you've got hawk decals up, basically stickers that you put on your windows so that it looks like there's a predator and they'll fly in a different direction. And that's something you could probably just get, what, online?
Yeah, you can get it online, or I'm sure the Audubon store in on Silk Farm Road in Concord may sell those.
Well, speaking of the Audubon store, you did mention that there's some events coming up.
Yeah.
What do you think that new bird watchers or, you know, people that are familiar with bird watching already, what would they like to do that's coming up in the next month or so?
There's so many opportunities. So the best clearinghouse for opportunities statewide would be New Hampshire Audubon. They have this wonderful celebration of birds and actually the birds and flowers. It's a birdathon bloomathon where people go out across the state to basically log all of the species and blooms that they find.
I love the name.
Yes, yeah, yeah. And so that's a terrific opportunity to get out and learn from people who know more than you and just have great fun. It's a great, there's great camaraderie at these events too. There's an International Migratory Bird Day in Pondicherry, which is the birds are fantastic, but Pondicherry as a scenic jewel is not to be missed. It's unsurpassed. And then I lead some trips out to Star Island, which my own personal opinion, Star Island is probably the best place in the state to witness songbird migration, at least. It doesn't have the canopy forests that we have elsewhere in the state, so it's very easy to see a huge diversity in relatively easy and scenic settings. So there are some opportunities to get out.
Well, we'll have links to all those events at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. And Eric, thank you so much for speaking with me.
My pleasure. Thanks, Taylor.
Eric Masterson is Land Protection Specialist with the Harris Center for Conservation Education. He's also the author of Birdwatching in New Hampshire. At sunrise on May 9th, birders from around the Granite State will converge on the Pondicherry National Wildlife Refuge in Jefferson, New Hampshire, for International Migratory Bird Day. Local naturalist and bird expert David Govatsky will be on hand to help identify the nearly 100 species of birds that will be arriving at the refuge, considered one of the top birding spots in the state. NHPR's Sean Hurley recently toured the area with Govatsky, and he sends us this report.
On one side of Airport Road, Piper Cubs and Cessnas fly in over Cherry Pond to land on the runway meadow of the Mount Washington Airport. On the other side, as David Govatsky points out, it's brown thrashers and widgeons flying in.
So this is Airport Marsh right here, and it's one of the best places in the North Country to really get a good look at a lot of not only water birds, but grassland birds, things like bobolinks, which will be here in another month.
After splashing down, two hooded mergansers begin to paddle toward the far shore of the marsh, where a lone rusty blackbird flips old leaves, looking for food. A moment after telling me the ospreys should be here any day now, a large shadow crosses our path, and we look up.
Well, that's an osprey, and that is a good sighting. That's the first one I've seen. You know, the really good birders, they can get a shadow flying over, and they can tell exactly what kind of a species it is. Just in the shadows.
4 to 5 million birds, Govatsky says, are migrating now, coming north from as far away as Argentina. Some stop here to nest and raise their young. Others move on to Canada.
I see some a pair of widgeons out there right now. They must have just flown in. I didn't see them earlier. It's like highway refueling stop to come here.
By profession, Govatsky is a forester. Retired now, he spent the last 25 years studying the birds, wildlife, and trees of the Pondicherry Refuge. In 2010, with his friend Sam Stoddard, Govatsky found the biggest black spruce in the nation. The 93-foot-tall national champion is just off the trail to Little Cherry Pond.
Well, we deposed that tree in Maine. I'm probably not happy with us, but...
Govatsky leads me down the mile-and-a-half Pondicherry Trail to Cherry Pond.
We hear a red-breasted nuthatch going a yank-yank-yank call. Oh, that's a rough grouse. This is a balsam poplar. It's really in the aspen family.
He goes on like this, naming nearly everything we see or hear. Moose tracks, larches, blights, mosses, cinnamon roses, winter wrens, and ravens.
Oh, here's a rough grouse scat right here. I can tell the difference between rough grouse and spruce grouse by the scat.
This isn't a boast. He's just letting me know there's a difference.
And I hear a song sparrow, and there's some swamp sparrows here.
On the raised berm of Shore Path, we pass along the edge of the 100-acre pond. Though set at the lowest part of the valley, the land surrounding Cherry Pond is so flat for such a distance, there's a wide-open sense of vista.
Look at these boulders. Look what the ice did and moved it here. I've had several geologists come out here, and I don't tell them anything, and I ask them, what caused this? Yeah, they didn't know.
What he means here is the rounded ridge of earth encircling the pond. As you walk the trail, you do so at height, 5 or 6 feet above the water, on a rare geologic feature Govatsky calls an ice push rampart.
And what happens when water freezes, it expands and gets much bigger. And so it's like a bulldozer. Every year for 12,000 years, it has pushed gravel and rocks and boulders up here to form this berm, which goes almost the entire way around this pond.
Scattered throughout the refuge are 7 benches, along with a 100-foot boardwalk that leads out over the pond to the Tudor Richards viewing platform.
We call them dalliance points. It's a technical term. Or you can dilly-dally and you can dream.
On May 9th, the gathered birders will walk the ice push ramparts and daydream at the dalliance points. And if they wonder about any of the 100 species of birds flying in, or want to know where the champion black spruce stands, or the name of any tree, or really anything they see or come upon, David Govatsky will be there, happy to oblige.
There's a couple of Canada geese flying in.
For Word of Mouth, I'm Sean Hurley.
If you're heading out for International Migratory Bird Day, you'll probably want to bring your camera. Too bad most of the photos you take will probably come out blurry. Word of Mouth celebrates bad bird photos after the break.
Word of Mouth!
When it comes to photography, there are few subjects more beautiful and more challenging than birds. But for every majestic image of a raptor catching prey midair or delicate hummingbird hovering near a flower, there are at least 100 bad photos that didn't make the cut. Carl Meacham is a freelance writer and the unintentional creator of one of the funniest Twitter memes I've seen this year, hashtag worst bird pick. So, Carl, how did hashtag worst bird pick get started?
I took a picture of an eastern bluebird sometime this winter that was particularly terrible. The bird was sitting just above eye level in profile. I thought it was an excellent picture. It wasn't all that far away. And when I took it, the background turned out to be perfectly in focus. Once I got home and saw the photo, and the bird was rather blurry, but just clear enough that you could still tell what it was.
So it looks almost like you were trying to take a picture of some branches, and this bird just kind of like got in the way. You photobombed your picture.
Exactly, that's what it looks like. But sadly, I was very intent on this this beautiful bird. It just didn't turn out.
So you posted that to the web, and what happened?
So I posted it to the web with a silly caption. But within hours, I think, someone, a Twitter pal of mine, responded with his own terrible picture of a buried thrush, I think. He lives on the West Coast. And then he said, can we make this happen? And wrote hashtag worst bird pick. It's great to see, you know, most memes, you never see the first coining of the hashtag.
Yeah, it's the origin is almost always sort of shrouded in mystery.
Exactly, but in this one, it's not. There's really like a tweet zero. I guess mine is tweet zero, but his is like tweet one or two.
And all of a sudden from there, it took off, and it turns out that there are a lot of people with really, really bad bird photos. What is it about birds as a subject for photography that it's so easy to mess it up? Is it just that, you know, we're zooming in really far because generally we're not very close?
That is frequently it, but it doesn't help that they're always moving around. It doesn't help that most of them are really tiny. There are just a million things that make them great photo subjects, but also really, really difficult photo subjects. One of my favorites of mine is 99% just a nice sky, and then at the bottom left corner, there's like this white tail. And what's funny is that it was a bald eagle, and I was so thrilled to be getting this bird, and you know, a magnificent subject, but terribly taken.
Now, do you have suggestions for how to take your worst bird pick and turn it around?
And turn it around? What do you mean?
I don't know. Is there a silver lining here? That's all I'm looking for.
Right. No, there's not. You can improve your photography skills, which takes years of expertise and you know, practice. But you know, this is not a tragic thing. The fact that people are out taking pictures of birds shows that they're, you know, inspired by their environment and by their lovely subjects. And the fact that 99% of them are going to turn out terrible is, you know, it's almost inevitable.
That was Carl Meacham, freelance writer and amateur birder. You can follow him on Twitter at The Inept Birder. Check out some photos from hashtag Worst Bird Pick and read Carl's article for Audubon on its origins at wordofmouthradio.org. And if you've got some of your own terrible bird photography, please share it with us on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio. And our next story is about a swift bird that can be tough to capture on film, the Roadrunner. Alex Chadwick of BirdNote brings us this tale from Big Bend National Park in southwest Texas.
We're on a dirt and gravel road in a place called Dugout Wells. I'm looking for birds with a guide.
I'm Bart Flippo. I live in Terlingua, Texas. I'm a retired park ranger. Let's go birding. Did you hear that? That's the Roadrunner.
He stays busy finding birds, though not very successfully at the moment. And in place of birds, he offers a bird story.
Roadrunners. I'll tell you a Roadrunner story.
This is a bird I know only through the cartoon, though I do see them on the local roads, and they are runners. Small, light, very alert, and quick. In the cartoon, the Roadrunner is potential prey for a hungry coyote. But in life, the bird is an excellent predator.
They eat lizards, snakes, other birds, birds' nests, cheetos, small children, cats, dogs, everything.
And they don't care who's watching. A Big Bend true tale.
A number of years ago, I was leading a birding program for the public. I had a bunch of people. It wasn't really birding. It was more like a rodeo. There was like 50 people, you know.
50. That's a lot of people to take birding. Two can be a lot.
We're right down there at Rio Grande Village, and there were a bunch of sparrows that were in there. There were like 5-6 different species.
The 50 people circled the sparrows. Everyone got out binoculars.
And there was one odd sparrow in there. And I looked at it, and I was so surprised. It was like, wow, that's a Baird sparrow. A Baird sparrow is a very rare, declining species.
Uh-oh. I don't like where this is going.
And I'm like, wow, this is great. And I'm expounding on this Baird sparrow mixed in with the chipping sparrows and all the other sparrows. And everybody were watching this very rare sparrow. And then out of the corner of my eye, I see movement on the ground, and here comes a Roadrunner. And then it goes into the crouch. And you know when a Roadrunner's hunting, they get low, tail straight out, and they just make a beeline.
No, 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 no.
And all the other sparrows jump when this Roadrunner comes in, except the Baird's. The Baird's has its head down, getting a piece of seed or something, I don't know. And it was that fast. The Roadrunner snags this Baird sparrow. There's like 100 sparrows in there, and it picks the one, the rarest sparrow. And I see a guy, he's got his camera. He's in the group, and I say, photograph that, quick, quick. because back then it was a review species in Texas.
Meaning it's rare, and if you see one, you're supposed to get a picture.
So he snaps a picture.
Yes, of a roadrunner going home with a Baird sparrow sandwich.
And its wings are spread, and it's gone. It's dead. It's going to be eaten.
But is this now deceased rarity to end as just another roadkill in the roadrunner story, or might it achieve more? The Texas Bird Records Committee certified that the bird in the photo, the dead one, was a Baird's sparrow, and added that this was the first time the committee had ever certified a photo of a rare bird that was being eaten.
So the Roadrunner helped at that respect.
Mark Filippo finds birds and stories in Big Bend National Park in southwest Texas. For Bird Note, this is Alex Chapman.
Thanks for your listening time today. There's much more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org, where you can also subscribe to the Word of Mouth podcast. You can sign up for it by searching Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes. And if you're into it, write a review, pass it on, tell a friend. After all, the best suggestions travel by word of mouth. I'm Taylor Quimby in for Virginia Prescott. We'll be back with more Word of Mouth tomorrow at 2, right here on New Hampshire Public Radio.